From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. South African politics haven't been this volatile since the end of apartheid more than a decade ago. Nelson Mandela led the African National Congress, or ANC, from the time it was a revolutionary group fighting apartheid. He continued his leadership as an elected president. The ANC is still the nation's ruling party, but it could be close to splitting into two factions. Divisions within the ANC deepened last month when President Thabo Mbeki was ousted by party officials loyal to his rival Jacob Zuma. Several South African government leaders have resigned to show solidarity with Mbeki. The man in the hot seat, Jacob Zuma. He now leads the party and is expected to run for president. He's also been in the midst of a convoluted corruption trial. We asked Jacob Zuma where he sees the ANC heading.
Well, as you know, the ANC in South Africa determines the priorities and determines the direction and policies. Last December, we had our national conference wherein we took very specific resolutions which were aimed at highlighting the key issues, and to mention a few is the issue of education, because we believe that education was identified as an instrument to oppress the majority, and if we are to complete their liberation, we have to take very concerted effort to ensure that education is a critical and fundamental requirement and challenge that we've got to deal with. We also identified the issue of health care, given the diseases that affect our people, as an area that we are going to be focusing on and prioritizing. We also identified the issue of rural development, which goes a long way to address our poverty. Also, we identified the issue of the crime in South Africa, that as an issue of focus, we'll be looking at the details of all of this.
South Africa is a driver of not only economies throughout Africa, but a driver of trade around the world. And yet your nation is divided by the lines of class, by the lines of ethnicity, by the lines of race. What do you see as the number one priority for uniting people around a common political goal, people who don't even like each other?
Well, firstly, you should take into account that South Africa comes from a very divided racially kind of society, wherein racism, more than any other kind, was institutionalized. And we had to tackle this from the beginning and indeed establish a new nation, which we call the Rainbow Nation. The important thing about it is that we did not say, because there's been racism, then we're not going to talk about it. We identified diversity in South Africa as important component for the unity of South Africa, that any different national group, whether by color or by size, is not less important than the other, that all national groups are equal. They should be equal in everything. That is a platform from which we move, and therefore say South Africa is in fact a multiracial society. But it is also important to bear in mind that the issue of race and ethnicity is not peculiar to South Africa. It's an international problem. In some places, it has caused wars and genocides and mass killings. But I think in South Africa, we did not shy away from the fact that we are different national groups. And the current situation, I think people who raise the issue of race or ethnicity as a major problem in South Africa, they are actually exaggerating the situation. The question then that challenges all of us, how do we deal with the policies in terms of economic development, in terms of the opportunities, that you address that as the second most important area of uniting ethnicities and everybody else?
Let me ask you for a concrete example of something that you think has failed in terms of how South Africa has approached the economy post-apartheid and how you think it could be fixed?
Well, I'm not sure whether I could identify that these specific things has failed. I'm sure critics standing out there could be in a better position to do so. What has come, I think very clearly, is that as we move forward, there has been the widening of the gap in terms of the statistics between the rich and the poor. So this is what you discover as you implement your correct policy. So the challenge is, how do we close the gap? How do we encourage the particular sides of economy to move so that you could raise the standard and the opportunities of those who are disadvantaged?
Let me go to two specific issues that intersect with the economy. One of them is immigration. There have been waves of people fleeing Zimbabwe, for example, coming to South Africa, and there also has been a corresponding wave of anti-immigrant violence. So when you think about South Africa's need to be a leader in the region and to respect the needs of people who are in dire straits versus the needs of the people who are your own citizens, how do you make a specific choice between how to deal with people who have crossed your border illegally but who may be malnourished and who may need help versus the people who are already in your country?
Well, that is a challenge that faces many countries. If people are pushed by the situation from their countries, you cannot say, go away. South Africa tended to adopt a policy that when people come to South Africa, instead of creating refugee camps, you actually allow them to integrate to society so that they are part of society in one form or the other. But I think what maybe we did not do is to ensure that we record everybody who comes very meticulously so that we know the numbers of the people are in the country, those who have got skills and those who do not have skills, and how to handle that issue. But they are not just from Zimbabwe only, they are from many countries in the continent. Of course, in South Africa, as you said, there were some conflicts that happened in the recent past. But what did we discover specifically in what has been called xenophobia? We actually discovered that key, or at the center of all of this, was in fact the question of criminality. Criminals who wanted to take advantage so that they could take the economic things that people were coming from outside were doing. That's what we discovered as a major factor. And therefore, it means crime in South Africa, in a sense, contributed to this and influenced this kind of a situation, because people in South Africa have never been xenophobic.
Let's move into the mix of domestic and international politics. Thabo Mbeki, the former president, with whom you had, I understand, a friendship and then a rivalry, was someone who has been trying to negotiate a brokered co-government in Zimbabwe, a functional co-government between rivals there. Those talks seem to have fallen apart. What's your role, if any, in trying to make sure that this coalition government, this fragile coalition government in Zimbabwe, continues? Or because of your political issues with Thabo Mbeki, is that just an area where you feel you can't operate your influence?
Firstly, Mbeki has been my comrade and friend all the time. He continues to be, and I'm not certain that we could describe me and Mbeki as rivalries. But of course, We will do what we've been doing all the time. We've been part of interacting with the Zimbabweans, in addition to what former President Mbeki was doing, talking to ZANU-PF, talking to MDC to say let us find a solution, encouraging everybody. I think we'll continue to do so to ensure that the situation is resolved in Zimbabwe, because the point that we've been making to our brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe is that the plight of the Zimbabwean people is too big a challenge. It is important that they put the interests of the country and the people of their country first in order to resolve the issue, so that once they put that in mind, it should be easy to compromise on the difficulties that they have as they want to implement their agreement.
I have to ask you about something delicate that I know many people have asked you about, which was an allegation of rape, which was eventually tossed out. But you did admit to having sex with an HIV-positive woman without a condom. What have you learned from that experience? And what I mean by that is, what have you learned from the outrage that came from many quarters, from AIDS activists in particular, ordinary citizens saying, how could a man we esteem so much be so bullheaded about this? Because we've known for years that taking a shower will not help in any way with HIV. What have you learned from that experience?
I think the question of the shower has been exaggerated by the media. I think we dealt with that matter in South Africa very well. And there was a prosecution that was asking meticulous, detailed questions as to what happened, for an example, at this point, what happened at that point. So we had to explain every other thing. And the media picked this one up to say that I said, if you take a shower, then you cure AIDS. I never said so. And for that mistake, I apologize publicly to the nation. And I'm sure we all say to air is human. There's nobody who's super in this world. I think to me, once I realized and I learned that I made a mistake and I apologize and the matter, and I think the South African people appreciated that, and that's why they have confidence in me.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've certainly covered a lot of ground. Thank you.
Thank you very much to you and your listeners.
We've been speaking with Jacob Zuma, the leader of the ruling party in South Africa, the African National Congress, or ANC. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We just heard from South Africa's ruling party leader, Jacob Zuma of the African National Congress. For analysis, we've got Amira Woods. She is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hey, Amira.
Hey, Farai.
So did Jacob Zuma say anything that surprised you, first of all?
Well, he said a number of things. I think I was really surprised at his comments on the xenophobic acts in South Africa. Pitting those as issues of crime and violence, I thought just did not hit true. You know, it didn't ring true for I. I think clearly what was at issue in South Africa, both in the actions that were xenophobic actions and in this push for Zuma, is an economic condition where people really felt that their hopes and dreams of the apartheid days have not been met. And I think there is an economic clamoring for change. Oftentimes that ends up taking some negative consequences, as was the case when the foreigners were targeted. But in the case of the political change, it has brought forth a vibrant process where the ANC is now being challenged from within. And this is what brought Zuma to power. So I think downplaying really the economic conditions within South Africa was a bit of a surprise for me.
It sounds as if you think that the fragmentation within the party is a good thing.
Well, I think clearly, you know, democracies are vibrant spaces where the will of the people gets expressed. And I think in South Africa, you have some definite cleavages. You have a working class, you have working families, you have poor and marginalized, impoverished communities that have really so many needs for housing, for health care, for decent jobs that have not been met in the years really since the end of the apartheid era. And I think it is those cleavages that are so stark today, and when demands from the people become at the level of political and party functioning, I think it is those demands that have to be heard. And so I do think that having differences within the party, within the South African political environment, it's a good thing for democracy and it's a good thing for the people.
How do you think he contextualized himself vis-a-vis Thabo Mbeki? He says, oh, he wasn't my rival, he was my comrade. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there is this whole sense of we were all friends, you know. Mbeki came from a different tradition, was part of the ANC, but Mbeki had this sense of the learned one, you know, a scholarly one. And clearly Zuma comes from a different tradition where he was seen as a leader of the military wing of the ANC and a staunch leader of that element within the party, less scholarly, educated himself, as many say. I mean, it is a different tradition that he represents. And yet I think he's trying to, you know, we have the election in the U.S. where the mantra is about change, change, change. And I think for Zuma, there's a tug that the mantra may be things will not necessarily change. That is both a mantra for the ANC to say we have to stay true to the principles of the ANC, but also, you know, we have to be strong in spite of all the different demands within the party to keep the party united.
When you think about the corruption charges and the trial, the rape trial that he went through, what lasting marks do those leave?
Well, I think it has not only lasting marks on Zuma and on South Africa, but in fact on Africa as a whole. I think in this age of when the HIV/AIDS crisis has gripped the world and the pandemic has had such devastating impacts around the world, to have someone in a position of political leadership, regardless of whom they are, make comments that seem really, you know, sophomoric, seems a little bit insignificant as a way of describing it. Absurd, really. You know, these comments that he made in spite of his apologies, thinking that, you know, you'll take a shower and that will protect you, when clearly the science speaks otherwise of this disease. So I think it is really sad that those comments were made, that behavior was condoned. And I think clearly, as Zuma quite rightly said, that the court of public opinion judged him and judged him poorly. But in spite of that, the ANC has put their backing towards him. And we will well see in April of 2009, President Zuma taking hold and taking office in South Africa and representing not only the South African people, but much of Africa throughout these international fora that South Africa is so well placed.
So, although that election hasn't taken place yet, you sound extremely confident that he will become the president of South Africa.
Well, Farai, you know, the ANC won 67% of the vote last go round. And I think they, you know, in spite of all of the pressures, they maintain a solid hold on so much of the country because of the history of having fought, you know, having been the liberators against the apartheid regime. And so I think there is tremendously high popular sentiment in support of the ANC. And I think it will take time before there is a consolidation of any type of oppositional party within South Africa. I think there may well be. We see the cleavages. You know, you have the defense minister, Lakota, speaking out forcefully about starting another party. And you have these sentiments being expressed. But I think it will take time before any other party is able to garner the level of popular support and also the level of political machinery that the ANC currently has in South Africa.
Amira, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you, Farai.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. A couple of weekends ago, General Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama made big news. Since then, we've seen a member of Al-Qaeda endorse one of the candidates, and many more newspapers and magazines have had their say. Some chose Senator John McCain, others Senator Barack Obama. A few chose not to endorse anyone. For more on the power of media endorsements specifically, we have Greg Mitchell, editor of Editor and Publisher Magazine, Alfred Edmond Jr., editor-in-chief of Black Enterprise Magazine, and Carlos Sanchez, editor-in-chief of the Waco Tribune Herald newspaper. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing
Hello.
Great. So, Greg, yesterday your publication tallied the newspaper endorsements from across the country. So what did you find out?
Well, we've actually updated it today, so an hour ago, so I can give you the latest, which is 222 daily newspapers for Obama and only 93 for McCain. Now, that may not surprise some people. Some people think, you know, liberal bias and so forth. However, I should point out that 4 years ago, John Kerry and George Bush virtually split the endorsements right down the middle. And historically, going back many decades, Democrats have almost never won the most endorsements. And when they have won, it's been by a very bare margin. So this year, it's a completely unprecedented and landslide for the Democrat.
What does that really mean? Do you think that because of what you just pointed out, that it usually is much tighter,
right,
that this effectively should be taken as a bellwether that Barack Obama is perhaps in a more solid lead than even the polls would state?
Well, I think so. I mean, we can talk later about whether endorsements mean something. I think they do mean something. What's quite striking, just looking at the endorsements, is a couple things. One thing, we've already tallied at least 48, and I suspect the number is going to end up much, much higher, number of newspapers that endorsed Bush in 2004 who have now endorsed Obama. And this includes many newspapers in red states. Three of the top five newspapers in Texas have switched from Bush to Obama. It's sort of a shocking turn of events. So I think that's quite significant. And if you just go around the country to the major cities, it's just one city after another, the top newspaper has endorsed Obama. And it also, just one other thing I'll mention, what's most striking in these editorials, and this includes from the most GOP-leaning newspapers in the past, is the utter, almost disgust that you read for the McCain choice of Sarah Palin as vice president. I sort of predicted about 7 weeks ago that the pick of Palin would turn out to be a political disaster for McCain, and certainly in the view of the newspapers and in the latest polls, that seems to be true.
All right, Carlos Sanchez, who did you endorse in 2000, 2004, and this year?
In 2000, we endorsed George W. Bush, who's actually one of our locals. His Crawford Ranch is in our readership area. In 2004, however, we chose to endorse John Kerry, much to the consternation of a large part of the public who likes to consider themselves a part of Bush country.
And this time around?
This year, we chose none of the above. We gave great deliberation to the thought of which direction to endorse. And a couple of things became clear. One is, historically, this is the longest-lasting presidential election that we've ever witnessed in this country. Along those lines, for the better part of 20 months, I have been getting a barrage of emails from various constituencies supporting one candidate or the other. And without a single almost unanimously, the reason that these emailers were choosing one candidate invariably was because the other candidate was evil for some reason or another. And this has kept up with something thematic that we have been trying on our editorial pages for the past several years, and that is the need for civility among public discourse in our community. And we therefore decided to remove ourselves from the equation this election cycle and point to something that we thought was much more profoundly disturbing about this election cycle, and that is how uncivil public discourse has grown in this country.
So you made a point of saying, look, we're not doing this because folks need to get a grip.
Not only need to get a grip, but pointing out, as we did in our editorial, that on November 5th, the day after someone is chosen to be next president, you can pretty much guarantee that half of our country, either actively or passively, will begin the process of undermining the winner. And we figure, given the stakes that are going on in this country at this time, that is just a game we can no longer afford to play.
Alfred, who did you choose and why? And is it typical for you to endorse?
Well, we endorse Barack Obama, and we actually endorsed him way back in our January 2008 issue, which would have gone to press really in November, even before the Iowa caucuses. It's the first time we've ever endorsed a candidate for president. Now, I want to qualify that a little bit. When Jesse Jackson ran in 84 and in 88, we certainly championed his run as important to African-Americans' involvement in the political process. Shirley Chisholm ran in 1972, and she was actually on the first advisory board of Black Enterprise magazine when it was founded in 1970. And that was supported as something that was an important step for African-American and female participation in the political process. But this is the first time we've said this is the right person for the job. The fact that he's Black obviously has certain meaning to the Black Enterprise audience, but our endorsement really laid out why this is the right person for the entire country, not just for Black Enterprise readers or Black people in general.
There have been many Black candidates for president, some of them coming in more from a protest vote angle, some for the Democratic Party, some for the Republican Party. Right now you've got Alan Keyes running, as well as Cynthia McKinney. You have, as well as Barack Obama, you have a wide variety of Black folks running for president this time around. What is it that you specifically liked from a business perspective about Senator Barack Obama?
Well, it was really talking about who has the best plan for the economy. Now, at the time that we endorsed him in the beginning of the year, no one on either side of the political spectrum could have predicted that the economy would be where it is today. If we had, we probably would have done some different things with our 401ks than we ended up doing. But our feeling was that this was going to be the right person to really do what needed to be done even before this economic crisis. The middle class, no matter where you live, no matter what your race or your background or even your political persuasion, has been neglected over the last, I would say, the last 15 to 20 years, certainly over the last 8 to 12. And we saw his platform for his tax policies, his commitment to education, his commitment to environmental jobs as key to jump-starting what had to be a return to really backing up and boosting the middle class. And that's how we felt strongly. And that naturally helps small businesses, small Black-owned businesses, those interested in education, production of competitive professionals across industries.
All right. I want to squeeze in enough time to get back to both Greg and Carlos. Greg, when you listen to these two gentlemen talk about why they made the decisions to do what they did, that is, to endorse Obama in one case and to not endorse either candidate, what does it mean to a publication to do an endorsement or not?
Well, again, some people who feel that there's a liberal bias in the media usually jump on any endorsement as proof of that if it goes in the liberal direction. But, of course, newspapers have been endorsing candidates since the beginning of time in the USA. It's nothing new, and they've done it regularly without a lot of controversy. It just seems that now some people feel, and I think legitimately in some cases, that endorsing a candidate tips your hand too much. And I would say that vast numbers of readers don't even understand that there is a separation between a newspaper's editorial staff and their newsroom. They assume they're all marching together and when actually you have many newspapers that, let's say, are quite conservative editorially and their newsrooms very independent or vice versa. So,
well, on that point, Carlos, did you get any negative response to people who say, well, we wanted your endorsement. We wanted you to endorse someone.
We did receive a lot of negative response. We got expressions of support, but the common criticism is that we were being spineless for not choosing one candidate over the other. But one thing that I pointed out to one of the gentlemen who sent me an email criticizing our lack of an endorsement is that he went on to specify various positions as to why his candidate should be chosen. And I pointed out to him that was the very first email I had gotten in 20 months in which positions were taken as opposed to attacks being waged.
Well, Carlos, on that note, I want to thank you all so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were talking to Carlos Sanchez, editor-in-chief of the Waco Tribune-Herald, who spoke to us from KWBU in Waco, Texas, Greg Mitchell, editor of Editor and Publisher magazine, and Alfred Edmond Jr., editor-in-chief of Black Enterprise magazine, who joined us from our New York studios. Next on News and Notes, images of the presidential candidates. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Art School Meets Political Boot Camp. Images of Senator Barack Obama have been altered, remade, and plastered on walls, bumper stickers, and clothing. Of course, you can find them online as well. Barack Obama's image has become, for better or worse, an icon. For example, Los Angeles-based artist Shepard Fairey created an iconic poster of Obama's face with the word hope, rendered in red, white, and blue. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to two experts on the history of political images, but now we turn to the artist Shepard Fairey. How are you?
I'm great.
So how did this image get started? I mean, you're not someone who just came as a, you know, you didn't just breeze into doing graphic art. You've been doing it for years very successfully. But what about this image called to you?
Well, I've been making political graphics for a while, but most of them have been negative, especially criticizing the policies of the Bush administration. And I think for once, I was inspired to make a positive political graphic because I felt that Barack Obama was an unusual candidate, a special candidate, and that it was worth putting my efforts into making something positive, which is a bit of a departure for me. The image itself, I felt I should make something that portrayed Obama as having vision and the ability to lead, and that's very abstract, but I think you know it when you see it. So I looked for an image that I could illustrate from that I think portrayed those qualities. And I wanted to make this image actually very patriotic and reverent because I wanted it to pique the interest of people that maybe weren't converted already to his cause. And I think that most of my friends, the way my art usually leans, would have already been Obama supporters. So I actually made something that I felt was maybe going to transcend the counterculture.
When was the first moment that you knew that your art had gone viral?
Almost immediately, after I posted the initial graphic on my website, letting people know that I was going to create a screen-printed poster for sale, a lot of blogs and even news outlets picked up on it, which was surprising to me. I think that maybe that happened because I have a history of when I make an image, it ends up being put out there on the street and manifesting in various forms. So maybe there was a bit of an expectation. But I actually sold my initial run of posters for less than I sell my usual posters for, figuring that maybe a partisan image would have a lower demand. And immediately, not only did the image go viral, but it was being sold on eBay for between $1,000 and $5,000 when I sold the initial print run for $45 each. So it far exceeded my expectations for, just its resonance and its demand.
What you did seems, in a way, well-suited for grassroots campaigning. You know, people can take this image that you have, get a version of it that's online, print it out, take it and wave it around in the physical world, or they can attach it to a website. Do you ever feel that people have crossed a line with use of your image, though, that the way in which people have decided to replicate it or alter it is something that you've got to put a stop to, and can you put a stop to it?
Well, my objective in creating the image was just to make people curious about Obama. They would check him out further and see his merits the way I see them, hopefully. And I've put every dime that I've made from Obama posters and art back into either making more materials or donating to the campaign up to the legal limit. However, there are some people who are making bootlegs and they're just pocketing the money. And I try to spend my time doing positive things, but I don't think that's right. So I've tried to at least get the worst offenders selling shirts in airports and things like that and have them divert some of their profits back to the Obama campaign, not to me. But really what I think all the knockoffs, bootlegs, parodies say is how much the image has resonated and how much it's become a reference point, a symbolic reference point. So in that sense, I'm very happy that people care to riff off of it. And really all is forgiven if Obama gets elected.
Do you see yourself at this point as a surrogate for the campaign, having come from the background, like you said, of doing art that was much more antagonistic in your face? At this point, you have been referenced probably in as many campaign articles as, you know, any staffer on the Obama campaign itself. So do you see yourself as a kind of Obama surrogate?
Well, I do think that I'm fairly well educated about where Obama's coming from, all of his policy points, but I just consider myself an artist, and I would leave it up to the viewer, hopefully, to just be inspired by my image to go and find out more about Obama on their own. His website lays it out pretty clearly. You know, I think my job is to create an image that has some heartfelt passion behind it, that then the viewer says, okay, this image was obviously inspired. Let me see what inspired the person to create it. That's really my job, I think. You know, if people want to ask me why I support Obama, I'm glad to let them know. But I think it says more about media culture than my qualification as a surrogate that I've gotten so much attention.
Well, Shepard, thank you.
Thank you.
That was the artist Shepard Fairey. He's the founder of Studio Number One, and that's a design company based in Los Angeles. Of course, how political images get used reshapes not only elections, it can shape entire cultural sensibilities. Here to talk about that, we've got Deborah Willis, co-editor of the book Obama, The Historic Campaign and Photographs, and Stephen Seidman, the author of Posters, Propaganda, and Persuasion, in Election Campaigns Around the World and Through History. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Happy to be here, Farai.
Thank you. So I'm going to start with you, Deborah, because Shepard Fairey, with whom we just spoke, his poster is on the back page of your book.
Yes.
And in order to produce this book, and you are someone who's a world-acclaimed cultural curator, in order to have produced this book, produced with Kevin Merida of The Washington Post, you had to do this really fast.
Yes.
So how did you even come up with the idea and decide to put it into action?
Well, as you know, I've looked at photographs for a long time, and I'm a close friend of someone who is interested in talking about images. I have a number of friends, rather, who are interested in talking about images, and one was my editor for the book HarperCollins, and Amistad HarperCollins, Dawn Davis. She asked if I would be interested in putting together a book of photographs. And at the time, she said, it has to be a quick turnaround. And it was a six-week turnaround. We worked closely with Kevin. I spent every day for about 8 hours a day for about 6 weeks looking at images online, meeting with photographers, and also families who actually visited and attended some of the rallies. So what I was looking for in that search was the range of audience response, portraits that told a story about the momentum of the campaign.
What's your favorite image in the whole book?
My favorite image is the fist bump, which is on the first leading page. It's kind of the contact sheet from the photographer's series of images where it leads into that, and it's a favorite because it shows the closeness of their relationship, the respect that they had, and just the love that she gave when she said, you're doing fine, it went well, and they just kind of touched each other. And that moment, to me, says a lot about respect for each other and respect for his words.
Stephen, let me go to you. Your book is about posters, propaganda, and persuasion. The word propaganda has come to have a completely negative meaning. Was it always negative?
No. In fact, originally, the word propaganda was synonymous with advertising. You could go back to the early 1900s in the New York Times, and they would routinely talk about ads as propaganda, with no negative connotation whatsoever. It was only in World War I when people felt misled by Allied propaganda that got us into the war that people began to feel negatively about the word propaganda.
Do you think that a lot of what has been put out during the 2008 election would fall under the rubric of propaganda, and if so, why?
Well, by my definition, all advertising and all political material is propaganda. It's always exaggerated and distorted and slanted to favor the candidate or the political party. So I would have to say it's all propaganda. Now, there's blatant propaganda, one might say, and there's propaganda that isn't so blatant.
When you took a look, Deborah, at this book as someone who was constructing it, the book has images of Obama, but it has more images of people processing Obama, either by wearing him in image form on a T-shirt, carrying a book that has him on it, lifting pieces of paper up to try to get an autograph from him, watching him at a forum. In some ways, your book is very much about, you know, how people deal with everyday icons. And what did you see when you saw these people and their reverence and their need for some kind of a hero?
Well, what I initially found is that he was of the people and they believed in a new voice. And as I turn the page today and kind of look back, and I looked at over 1,000, maybe 2,000 images, could have been 80,000 images. I feel like it's I've turned so many pages and looking at images. But what appealed to me was the response to him, and that's something that range from respect, awe. There is something that was, you know, awe-inspiring and biblical in one way, and then, you know, there was a sense of wanting to connect, and just the fact that the images that also included the cell phone cameras that were placed with every rally, people were taking photographs, and it was a sense that people wanted to be a part of the moment, and I think that is something that I found engaging and expressed the kind of beauty of the campaign is that everyone wanted to be a part of it, and that's the joy in what I found in the photographs.
Isn't there a danger in having not so much the book per se, but having a entire cultural canon of worship of a human being, you know, who is just that on some level, a human being, whether or not he becomes president? No matter what else he does or doesn't do, he's a human being. And yet some of these images are so reverential as to almost have a religious undertone to them. Isn't there a danger in that?
It is a danger, yes. I totally agree with that. But I think what's unique about it and that kind of saves it, I think, for me and the way that I edited the photographs is that there was a sense of hope. People were looking for hope and you know, we're a lot of people have dealt with despair in their lives and disappointment, and what I believe that they're hoping for, that this is a kind of a moment where they can hold on to something, and you know, it's not negative, it's not positive, but it's just something that creates a sense of complacency, but also an excitement. So there, that's what I experience in terms of feeling it. It is a danger, but then there's still a sense of hope.
Stephen, what about that danger of taking someone who is, you know, in the public eye, but pushing them into an almost messianic set of public images?
Well, I would worry that the expectations are being set so high for Barack Obama that inevitably when and if he becomes president, there might be disappointment for people who feel so fervent about him. You know, there's an image by Ray Noland, another guerrilla artist like Shepard Fairey. It's called The Dream, and the iconography is both religious, showing Obama as a saint, and even revolutionary, similar to posters of Mao Zedong in China. And in the background, there, you know, there's a sun and rays coming up behind Obama. So I would be worried that all this symbolism might lead to some disappointment inevitably in the future.
Speaking of the future, looking ahead, Deborah Willis, do you see people who are wearing all these T-shirts, wearing them, you know, perhaps over and over again until they fade away and get used as rags? Or are these the kind of things people are going to fold up and keep in their drawer and say, this was the T-shirt I wore the year when blank?
Well, I think it's going to be worn when the year, because 1968, this is 40 years after 1968, I see that people are recycling their T-shirts of 1968, of all of the iconic figures and the ones also that had the dreams and hope for a different future. And so I believe that they're not going to be worn as much, but I think they're going to be preserved for a long time.
What do you think, Stephen? Is all this imagery, these posters, these bits of ephemera, are they going to stick around and make it onto people's walls someday or maybe even to college campuses?
Oh, I think they will. You know, there's an interesting study that was done a few years ago in Belgium, and the winning party, the supporters of that party, kept the yard signs up for many, many months. Of course, the losers took theirs down immediately. And the researcher called this the basking in reflected glory effect. I think we may have something like that going on here in the United States in the future, too.
All right. Both of you, very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Deborah Willis, Chair and Professor of Photography and Imaging at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. She's also co-editor of the book Obama, The Historic Campaign in Photographs. She joined us from NPR's studios in New York. And Stephen A. Seidman is Chair and Associate Professor of the Department of Strategic Communication at Ithaca College in New York. His book is called Posters, Propaganda, and Persuasion in Election Campaigns Around the World and Through History. He joined us from the studios of Cornell University. You can watch the video we shot of some of the amazing images served up at the two national conventions this year at our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the presidential candidates get all purple on us, trying to grab the last undeclared voters in swing states. We'll get the latest from our political experts.